You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenlon.
The Independent Medicines and Medical Devices Safety Review, better known as the Cumberledge Review, published its report in July this year. Its findings should be of interest to anyone who might ever end up a patient in the UK healthcare system. However, it will be of particular interest to medical professionals and legal practitioners in the fields of clinical negligence, inquest, and public inquiry law. It's a lengthy report, running to 277 pages, that occasionally bristles with frustration and incredulity at the dysfunctional way in which the long-standing concerns of women have been handled in the past. In many ways, it echoes the findings of the inquiry into the breast surgeon Ian Paterson. Last month, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, responsible for NICE guidance, indicated it would be taking a number of steps in response to the review. And in recent weeks, a number of questions have been tabled in Parliament, asking what the government plans to do next. Here with me to discuss its key findings is Marina Wheeler QC. Marina, I'm delighted to welcome you back to the podcast.
Thank you, Emma.
Can you tell listeners, what is this review and why is it being talked about?
The review looks at three, what they call medical interventions, which went catastrophically wrong. It's being talked about because it is a very strong report. It was the result of some years' investigation by Baroness Cumberledge and her team. And it reported to the Secretary of State at a very sensitive time. It was on the 8th of July that Baroness Cumberledge reported to the Secretary of State. And that, of course, was a time at which we were all in full lockdown. And as she notes in her speech presenting the report, we were all applauding the NHS staff for, quite rightly, for the incredibly selfless work that was being done to keep everyone safe. But at the same time, she was revealing the conclusions of an investigation which led her and her team to say that they were astonished. And I'm going to just quote, if I may, what she said on that day. She said, "We've been astonished how the healthcare system," and she includes within that the NHS, private providers, regulators, professional bodies, manufacturers, and policymakers. So she said, "We've been astonished how the system is disjointed, siloed, unresponsive, and defensive." And then most damningly, she said, "It doesn't adequately recognize that patients are its sole purpose." So unsurprisingly, people sat up.
The report looked at three different interventions in particular. Can you tell us briefly about each of these?
So three interventions. The first was a product called Primados, which was a hormone pregnancy test taken in pill form. It was taken predominantly in the 1970s. And from about the late 60s, its use became associated with very significant birth defects, stillbirth, conditions including spina bifida, blindness, mutism, heart defects, learning difficulties, skeletal problems, and more, and indeed also with miscarriage. But despite there being a risk-free alternative, the drug wasn't withdrawn, and the regulator issued a warning in 75, but still women weren't informed of the risks, and the test continued to be used and prescribed until 1978. So that was the first product. The second was sodium valproate, which is a drug prescribed to treat epilepsy and bipolar disorder. There are some similarities. With sodium valproate, data had suggested from about the 80s that there was an association between the drug and physical malformations in children, and also later neurodevelopmental problems, which now have a term, fetal valproate spectrum disorder. And again, the women who were taking it, women of childbearing age, weren't informed of the risks, and so they weren't able to make informed decisions about family planning. And then the third intervention, which is perhaps the most widely publicized, is the pelvic mesh. And that's a device that's surgically inserted either through the abdomen or the vagina, usually made of polypropylene, so basically plastic, and it's used to relieve incontinence or organ prolapse. And it's important to say that many women found the procedure to be helpful, but many others found that it ruined their lives. And women reported excruciating pain, loss of mobility, and sexual function associated with the mesh. And the report was powerful because, in a sense, when you read those terms, and certainly, Emma, you and I will know, we read plenty of reports that use words like loss of mobility, pain, sexual function, and it's a bit abstract or clinical, but the report made it really very plain, having spoken to the women who'd been affected by these procedures, what impact it had had on their lives. For example, they described the pain as being excruciating, like having razors inside their bodies. This loss of sexual function, meaning having intercourse, was always painful, leading to marriages collapsing. Loss of mobility meant for some women they were confined to wheelchairs or couldn't sit in the same position for any length of time. So these were life-changing injuries and life-destroying in many cases.
You mentioned that the report authors spoke to a number of women, and I noted with particular interest that they had, in fact, met and listened to 700 women, sometimes accompanied by family members and with their children, who described their own personal experiences. And it's clear in the outline to the report and the letter accompanying it that Baroness Cumberledge was particularly affected by that personal, very intimate testimony. But the other thing I found particularly interesting was that the report actually defines the word gaslighting in its glossary. So it says this means to manipulate a person by psychological means into questioning his or her own sanity. And that is a phenomenon that women in particular are likely to be familiar with, even if it's a word that has only recently become mainstream. But is it relevant, do you think, that these products were all interventions designed primarily for women?
Yes, I think so. Certainly one of the overarching themes was that the women who suffered as a result of these interventions, when they complained about what they were experiencing, and perhaps this was most striking in relation to the mesh, when they complained about the pain and the symptoms that I've described, very often they felt they weren't listened to or they were brushed off. And there was a strong sense that the women got from clinicians they spoke to that they were thought to be exaggerating or they were being hysterical, and so they were brushed off. And gaslighting, you asked me specifically about that. Yes, Baroness Cumberledge said they were made to feel that they were unstable and that the symptoms were all in their heads. And she uses this particular phrase. She says that they were made to feel that these were women's issues and that it was just this time of life. One other quote, which was very striking in the report, which is from a former GP and a mesh-affected patient, who says, "To my former medical colleagues, I say that I accept that for the majority of women, this implant was a successful procedure. I do, however, believe there's a huge unconscious negative bias among you towards middle-aged females in chronic pain. As more information is coming out about the risks, some of you are still choosing to downplay or actually disbelieve these facts."
And so in the context of that culture of denial, downplaying and outright disbelief, what then did the report found went wrong?
Well, as you say, Emma, the report is, I think, 277 pages, and it's extremely detailed. And it reflects the fact that, unsurprisingly, in these three different procedures, what went wrong was complex, but there are some overarching themes that are worth highlighting. In a nutshell, these products were tested and then they were put on the market. There was a failure to recognize that putting on the market isn't the end of the process. And while they worked well for many people, for many they didn't. And for those that didn't, over time, as those women and in some cases children began to suffer side effects, this information didn't filter up. And when it did, nobody acted on it. So there was a failure at many levels. But then also, and I think this is a very interesting feature that the report focused on, the women's accounts of pain and suffering were very rarely reflected in what's known as adverse event reports, that are the manufacturer's way of recording problems with their products. And what happened was that these adverse event reports adopted a very narrow definition of a product's performance. So taking the mesh, for example, if the mesh relieved incontinence or supported the prolapsed organ, then it was said to be a success. But it didn't take into account the pain or the problems during intercourse or the lack of mobility. They didn't feature in the formal evaluation of the device because they weren't considered to be linked to the essential performance of the product. So what that meant was that the official record of how these products were faring, if I can put it that way, didn't record these really very dramatic side effects. And so many doctors were unaware that these were the outcomes. And that also accounts for why many of those GPs disbelieved patients who reported it to them. And then finally, in response to the question, what went wrong, the review was concerned about some of the relationships. Perhaps it's unfair to call it cozy, but the close relationships between the manufacturers, the regulators, and at times also the hospitals and clinicians. So, for example, there was concern about the movement of staff between one of the key regulators, so that being the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, the MHRA, the movement of staff between there and industry. And a feature of the report is a concern to try and look at whether these conflicts or potential conflicts of interest might also have played a role in downplaying of some of the side effects that were emerging from these products.
One of the things that I found particularly interesting in the context of this report is the discussion about consent and what that means and how much information a patient deserves and ought to have before they can make a choice that is considered informed consent per the definition of consent in the landmark case that listeners will be familiar with, Montgomery. Mm. And so I was wondering, does the report have anything in particular to say about consent?
It has a lot to say about consent. And I think those who are interested in it, and of course, it's an issue that spans the whole of the working of the healthcare system. And indeed, I think it's fair to say it's fundamental to the safe working of the system. And you mentioned the 2015 case, Montgomery and Lanarkshire Health Board. And what the case said was that consent needs to be framed about what information an individual patient requires. And what the report said, one of the really interesting observations, was that in response to that case, there was a huge proliferation of leaflets. So healthcare trusts produced leaflets for patients, but they were so extensive and so packed with information that they were often bewildering and counterproductive in a sense. So that what wasn't being done was, in many cases, a communicating of information to patients in a way that they could understand. What was also striking was simply that in some cases, so that I've described a sort of a provision of information that was hard to digest, but actually what the review found, and they said they were appalled in many instances, was that many of the women affected hadn't been informed of the risks at all of the procedures or of the products. And they didn't know what was being done to them, so that they might have some sense in a very general way. But for example, they may not have known that the implant was made of polypropylene, for example, and so had no awareness or understanding of what possible effects that could have. So the report, in a nutshell, found that there was a huge amount of work still to be done on the issue of consent.
Aside from issues to do with consent, what are the report's main recommendations?
Well, the report makes a huge number of recommendations, a number of them very detailed, directed to almost every body involved in the healthcare system, and some about just ways that they need to do things better. Complaints is obviously an area where there's a lot of work to be done. And one of the headline recommendations the report makes is that every healthcare body that has or receives complaints or communications with patients needs to appoint an individual, probably a board member, who oversees how the complaint system deals with the information that they are receiving. The report rejects any further NHS reorganisation. It says firmly that that can be a distraction, but it does make two, if I can call them, structural recommendations. One is that the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, so the MHRA, needs substantial revision. And that revision, the report says, should focus on adverse event reporting and the way it regulates devices. And it needs to engage with patients more. And the other structural change, and this is probably, if one is to pick one, this is probably the most significant recommendation. And that recommendation is that there ought to be a patient safety commissioner appointed, someone who stands outside of the existing healthcare system, someone who stands outside government, somebody who's a person of standing, answerable to Parliament, who will listen to patients, who will advocate for them, who will monitor trends and will demand action. So those two recommendations, I think, highlight an essential theme in the review, which is that what's needed to make the system operate more safely is that the patient voice has to be louder and that the relationship between clinician, regulator, producer needs to be looked at. And all of the other parts of the system need to make sure that they have a proper process for ensuring that patient concerns are taken on board. So the obvious concern in these cases was that perhaps clinicians, without necessarily realizing it, continued to be wedded to some of these products for a period of time after risks were being talked about because of their relationship with, or because of a close relationship with the producers of these products. One of, at least a striking feature of the report is also how the report deals with the question of litigation. And obviously that this will be of interest to any lawyers and is of course a concern, I think, for us reading the report, that the report found how little litigation seemed to do to help those who had suffered from these interventions. And while some successful claims were made against individual doctors, no product liability cases succeeded. I mean, clearly it's not a level playing field. Producers have all the information about the products. They conduct the trials. They frame the terms of references for the trials. When concerns are raised, as has happened in each of these cases, and the producers were asked to look back at the products, often they convene expert groups. But those expert groups, often what they produce is material that's not widely accessible. So recognizing that litigation is limited, what the review recommended was that there are schemes set up in order to help those who have been affected. Three individual schemes that will provide care and support to those who've been affected, and that they should be funded by a levy on manufacturers, but also possibly with some government money. And those schemes have precedents. They exist, for example, infected blood and other cases where vaccines have gone wrong. So the review recommended that those schemes be administered that should provide practical support as well as financial support, and that they should be administered by a redress agency on a no-blame, non-adversarial way.
So do you think as a result of this review, anything will change?
I hope that it will. I have to say it's a difficult report to ignore because it's a good report. It's a thorough report written by very well-respected experts in the area, and also just the scale of the failures that it highlights and the human cost is appalling. So it certainly, as I say, is hard to ignore. But I think there are two other reasons why there's some cause for optimism that things might change. And those reasons are COVID and Brexit. The reason that COVID is relevant is that the report actually does raise a number of issues that are highly relevant to the health crisis we're currently facing. We're all hoping and praying that there's a vaccine around the corner, but that vaccine will be a new product. And one big question is, will the public trust that that product is safe? Another question is, how, when it's on the market, will we deal with possible adverse effects of that product? What if things go wrong? Who will pay? The manufacturers? The government? So the government is looking urgently at all of that. And those are many of the issues that Cumberledge itself has raised. So there is a great impetus within government to try and properly address a lot of those issues. That may well tie in with some of the other work that the government is doing that it's required to do as a result of Brexit. Because at the end of the transition period, at the end of 2020, the UK will leave the current regime that regulates medicines and medical devices. And changes have to be made in order to deal with that. This is an opportunity, for example, with the adverse incident reports, to make them accessible to the public in a way that doesn't currently exist under the EU regime. And the review noted that the MHRA had said that when the EU regulatory regime was set up, it had proposed that these adverse event reports should be accessible to the public, but other member states had been unwilling. So now is a chance. If that is the way that the UK would like the system to work in the future, and certainly Cumberledge is recommending that it should be, now is an opportunity to restructure the system in a way that the patient is more central to how things operate. The review is obviously concerned to ensure that its recommendations are implemented. So it goes some lengths to underline the need for the government to focus on implementation quickly. And it also underlines the heavy responsibility on the government and the healthcare system to ensure that the review's advice is heeded. And the review does warn, specifically it says, that if its advice isn't heeded and another intervention causes damage on such a scale, then the government will not and should not be forgiven.
So it's a pretty stark warning there to any government minister that plans to simply put this in a desk drawer.
Yes, exactly.
As usual, we will include a link to everything that has been mentioned today, including the case of Montgomery, a link to the full Cumberledge report, and an article that was in the Quarterly Medical Law Review, written by Marina and Amelia Walker, also of One Crane Office Row. Marina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today and outlining in some succinct and pithy detail what is, in fact, a fairly comprehensive and lengthy report.
Thank you, Emma.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.